Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank
Gaffney. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people who I admire more for the incredible service that they're rendering our country in that war for the free world than our first guest. He is Dr. Zudi Jasser, a medical doctor by training, a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy, now retired, who served in medical capacities, among other places, on Capitol Hill. These days, he is, in addition to his medical practice, the president and founder of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. He has also organized the Muslim Reform Movement and authored a very important book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam, an American Muslim patriot's fight to save his faith. We catch up with Dr. Jasser in the days following tremendously important testimony that he provided to Senator Ted Cruz's Justice Committee's Oversight Subcommittee. And I cannot tell you, Zudi, how much I appreciate what you said there and how much I look forward to talking with you about your recommendations to the committee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Frank. And, hats off to Senator Cruz's team and all of his advisors. I'm sure that include many in your team because, you know, I have to tell you, as an American, there's nothing that hurts me more than to see my country dishonest to its people and dishonest to the world and controlled by foreign influence. And I think we hit it out of the park as far as explaining to America why honesty and terminology is so important.
I wonder if you might agree with me that I think this hearing, with its focus on willful blindness and the extent to which this has really come to characterize the official U.S. government attitude towards, jihadism, towards the ideology that animates it, as you know, Sharia is what its adherents call it, and the other elements of what you've described as political Islam, theocratic Islam, represent in terms of denying us, as you say, the information we need to prevail in a fight that has as much the interest, I think, of Muslims like yourself as it does the rest of us at stake.
What was great about this hearing was it focused on one issue and how the 9/11 report used jihad, Islam, Islamism 400 or 500 times, and then after that, every other report since has used it zero or one time. And how that terminology, while President Obama tries to patronize us and say, what's going to be solved if he changes one term? What solves is then the American people and our homeland security can be held accountable to the precursors. And the denial that the violent endpoints of political Islam and jihadism are not precursed by nonviolent or civilizational jihad or Sharia mentality of the Sharia state, that those precursors don't make any sense. And yet we have to hold our homeland security accountable to it and say, oh, why didn't you follow the father who was following the Taliban? Why didn't you follow the domestic violence? Why didn't you follow these other things? Well, those things aren't related to the current CVE paradigm. And my testimony was, for crying out loud, let's change it to CVI, Countering Violent Islamism, and the whole strategic security will change.
Yeah, you know, this is such a critical point. And again, Zudi Jasser, what I think you do that is simply incalculable importance is bring the perspective of somebody who's living within this community about which there is such concern, and your insights into what this kind of willful blindness means, not just to our ability to protect ourselves against jihadists, but what it means for people like yourself who are trying to help America prevail against this really toxic ideology. Discuss that a little bit, if you would, the emboldening and empowering of the enemies of our country rather than Muslims like yourself.
Yeah, the transformation and the narrative that the Muslim community is a monolith, whether they say the monolith is a peaceful religion or the other extreme that all Muslims are terrorists, both of those things embolden the enemy because it tells Muslims in America and it tells non-Muslims that, well, Islam is irreconcilable, we have to treat them as children, or we have to be beholden to the narrative from Saudi Arabia and Qatar that they are the true representatives of Islam. And I'll tell you, at the end of the day, that's what the Obama administration is afraid of. When they want to shake hands and work with the Saudi regime, Qatar, Turkey, other Islamists, and even Iran, they don't want to offend the narrative of those oppressors. So therefore, I would tell you, there's nothing that would melt away bigotry more than for the government to use these terms. And then Americans will say, wait a minute, oh, the Muslim community is not beholden to the theocrats of Iran and Saudi Arabia. They do disagree with them. The millions in the street in Egypt were rejecting the Brotherhood. And the Muslim reform movement would then have a seat at the table. But as long as there's no Islam and we hold our, you know, hands over our eyes and ears and pretend it doesn't exist, then the only people that can speak for us are the Brotherhood influencers within the White House, within the Department of Defense. And meanwhile, we become irrelevant because we have not had the resources and the attention and the platforms. And what this change in terminology would do is give us a platform to begin to say, you know what? And by the way, I hope no one believes for a minute that our Homeland Security isn't using these terms. The problem is they just don't write it into the books, but they have to in order to be doing any good work out there.
Yeah. But you drill down just a little bit on the role of the Muslim Brotherhood inside the wire of the U.S. government as you see it at this point. You called for an investigation of these groups, notably the Council on American Islamic Relations. But how are they actually now shaping policy along the lines you've just talked about?
Well, there's nothing more demonstrative of the fact that the center of gravity is always countering violent extremism, that somehow all they can talk about is the penchant for these militants to pick up a gun, to wear a suicide belt, but the ideology cannot play a role. And Farhan Akkara, even when pressed multiple times by senators, could not even answer the question whether radical Islam plays a role. And she even doubled down on the fact that it's harmful to say that and couldn't explain why. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood, once we start to understand that political Islam and Sharia's Islam is connected to radicalization, then they become foreign entities. They become enablers of the enemy's ideology. Until we get to that point, they continue to serve a purpose. So one of their law, and this is why they're part of the OIC lobby and why the OIC, even though domestically in countries like Qatar or Saudi Arabia may claim to be anti-brotherhood, globally in the land of war versus the land of Islam here in the West, they work together to push the Islamist narrative, because that Islamist narrative keeps America, the promoters of freedom and liberty across the world. We won't promote that as long as Islam is perceived as incompatible with freedom and Islam has one narrative. If it has multiple narratives, the Brotherhood influence goes away. So the whole crux of the Brotherhood's power in Washington and in the Beltway and the OIC power is based on pushing this mantra of Islamophobia and keeping us deaf and dumb to Sharia and the influence of theocratic ideas.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. And what we're going to be talking a little bit more about later in the program with Nina Shea, a friend of yours and mine, Vizuti, you've also been serving, of course, on a commission she long served on, the International Religious Freedom Commission. Notwithstanding the efforts of Farhan Akkara specifically to try to get you thrown off of that, and the irony of having this Muslim Brotherhood advocate, I know they call their group Muslim advocates, but it seems Muslim Brotherhood advocate is better descriptor, sitting next to you as you talked about this challenge for not just the soul of Islam, as you talk about in your book, but for America's security to the extent that we're relying on the wrong people. It was really, as you say, historic in terms of the importance both substantively and sort of in terms of the visuals.
We need to start having deep investigations on how the Council on American Islamic Relations, Muslim Public Affairs Council, and these other Islamist groups that I detailed in my testimony, how their operations actually make us weaker and how they're actually enabling foreign entities. And I'll tell you, I did push back to some of the senators about, you know, if we really want to see change in Syria and navigate a third pathway away from Assad's Iran and away from ISIS, that third pathway has to be led by Muslims. Istanbul was being attacked as we gave testimony, and those are Sunnis that are being attacked because of this internecine war.
That's absolutely right. Zuhdi Jasser, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I do hope you'll come back to us again very soon. And needless to say, I pray that you will stay safe and keep up the terrific work you do at the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, the Muslim Reform Movement, and of course, good luck with getting the word out around your book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam. Next up, Harold Rode. We'll talk about Turkey and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's our privilege to have with us one of the smartest guys I know about the Middle East, specifically about a very important country, much in the news these days, namely Turkey. He is Dr. Harold Rode. For many years, he served as the duty expert on this part of the world for the Department of Defense, including as the Turkish desk officer there for a time. These days, he is the senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute, specializing in reportage about Turkey, Iran, and other parts of the Middle East and our interests there and beyond. Harold Rode, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always a great privilege to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for what you just said. Nice to be with you.
Let's talk about Turkey. I was going to say let's talk Turkey, but that would be, I think, probably inappropriate to make light of what's happened there in the past couple of days, specifically this jihadist attack at the airport in Istanbul. Give us your take on what has happened and who might be responsible.
Well, first of all, Erdogan has been playing with the fundamentalists, meaning that he was supporting them. He was supporting ISIS in Syria. He's been supporting all sorts of groups. He's basically very pro and possibly part of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is why he hates Sisi in Egypt, because Sisi overthrew the Brotherhood. Now, in this particular instance here, playing with any of these extreme radical fundamental Islamic fundamentalist groups is like playing with fire, because you think that you can support them, but the slightest thing goes wrong, they'll turn around and they'll hurt you.
Hey, Harold, can I just ask you on that question, because I think it really cuts to the quick of this thing. But when you hear the Islamic State is potentially the party responsible for this attack, is it really a question of two competitors for the title of caliph, the leader of the Muslim world? And if so, is there a dime's worth of difference, really, between the ambitions of the Erdogan regime and those of the Islamic State? Give us a sense of are these two competitors for the title of leaders of the caliphate?
On one hand, the answer may be yes, but the question is, does it matter? Because the truth is, until we in the West eradicate all of these Islamic radicals, and I mean eradicate, if one goes away, another is just going to take its place. Because as long as they see us weak, then they're going to continue, they'll call it this name, they'll call it another name. All of a sudden, people who are a member of one group become a member of another group. We're obsessed with finding which group is responsible. I'm not sure it matters in the end. It's the bad guys who are the Islamic fundamentalists, which are responsible. And whatever their name, whatever their group, they must be made to go and meet Allah.
What does it mean, though, Harold, that among them is the president of an allied NATO nation, Recep Tayyip Erdogan?
Well, you're right. The question is, in fact, the answer. What does it mean? Let's hope that that after November, that when, you know, maybe it's after January, when we have a new president, one of them at least may be willing to re-examine our relationship with America's enemies. And Erdogan is an enemy of the West. He's an enemy of the non-Muslim world. And, I guess we'll have to see what happens.
We will indeed. But in the meantime, he has just undertaken a rapprochement after years of severely strained relations, really disrupted relations, I guess it's better to say, with Israel. What is that about? Harold, you know Israel very well. You understand, again, this region quite well. What's afoot there, and what are the implications of this rapprochement?
Well, this is on the surface only. Israel will need to sell gas, and as a result of Erdogan screwing up his relationship with Putin, the Russians stopped selling gas. So Israel needs to sell gas. The Turks desperately need gas. It's also a good route to send gas to Europe.
And so it suits everybody's economic needs. There is very clearly no love that Israel feels towards Erdogan, and Erdogan hates the Jews. He hates the Jewish state. And so there were a series of what appear to be external accommodations. For example, one of Turkey's conditions for a signing agreement with Israel for restoring relations was to end the blockade of Gaza, the Gaza Strip. And that's what the Mavi Marmara incident, which is the incident which, in 2010, which precipitated the Israel-Turkish break.
This was, of course, the freighter that the Turks sent directly to try to break the blockade of Gaza, and the Israelis stopped using a modicum of violence to do so.
Well, the Turks have given in, and they're going to send humanitarian aid, they call it now, to the people in the Gaza Strip, and that is going to go via the Israeli port of Ashdod, which means Israel will monitor absolutely everything that the Turks send there. The Turks want to complete building a hospital there. That's fine, but most of the hospitals in Gaza are also terrorist dens because the basements have all sorts of military equipment and things like that. They're not really hospitals. It's only on the surface they're hospitals.
Well, it's a vehicle for protecting those bases of operations, of course. Harold, one of the other nations with whom the Erdogan regime has just made amends, apparently, is Vladimir Putin's in Russia. Again, what's going on there, and what are the implications of that?
Well, Erdogan, according to the Kremlin, has apologized to Putin for having shot down the Russian airplane, which was along, depends which version you wish to believe, it was either over Syrian territory, it was about a year or so ago, or the Turkish version is for 17 seconds it flew over Turkey. Whatever the case, Russia has made Erdogan's life absolutely miserable. And in the Middle East, your personal honor is absolutely essential. And what that means is that under no circumstances can you admit that you were wrong. Under no circumstances can you apologize. I know this sounds alien to us here in the West, but that's the way it is. Middle East
never
do anything wrong.
In other words, right?
It's faith. Yes. And the fact that Erdogan has apologized to Russia shows. And of course, he hasn't said he has, but the Russians have said they have the document to prove it.
Made it public. Harold, now, does this mean that this sort of trying to clear the decks a bit in terms of the various difficulties his foreign policy has gotten into, that Erdogan will now be able to make a redoubled effort to consolidate his power and take his country still further in the direction of an Islamic republic, against the backdrop, again, of all of these things, including the violent attack this week?
Well, I wouldn't trust Erdogan as far as I could throw him, let's say. All I know is that his goal is to re-Islamify the government of Turkey, and he's largely succeeded in doing that. And after he does that, he wants to basically take over the entire Muslim world. He wants the Muslim world to be under his leadership as a caliph, and then basically find ways, and he's doing this already, to Islamify the rest of the world, because that's Islam's eventual goal, to take over the entire world. And that's what he's doing in Europe right now.
Indeed. And that is a subject for another conversation. Harold Rode, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for this tour de raison of what's going on in Turkey. I know you will keep up the terrific work you do at Gatestone Institute and hopefully come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk national security with a senior member of the House Armed Services Committee, Congressman Doug Lamborn of Colorado. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Today, a man at the center of a disaster appears before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The extent of that long-running disaster became clear on Tuesday when the panel's Oversight Subcommittee provided the first serious examination of its nature and implications since 9/11. Presumably, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson will try to dissemble or deflect attention from the evidence Senator Ted Cruz uncovered earlier this week. Johnson's department and the Pentagon, the FBI, the intelligence community, the State Department, and the White House itself have been pursuing policies dictated by the Muslim Brotherhood and other Sharia supremacists. This disastrous mistake is leaving us unacceptably and dangerously vulnerable to jihadist attacks and subversion. Senators must hold Secretary Johnson accountable and redouble their oversight efforts by doing a far broader damage assessment, if necessary by subpoenaing witnesses who will otherwise be punished for revealing its full magnitude. This is Frank Gaffney.
Flights with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Flights. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by a distinguished member of the House of Representatives, a senior member of the Armed Services Committee in that body, the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee's Energy Subcommittee, a very important post. He is Representative Doug Lamborn, representing the people of the 5th Congressional District in Colorado. He serves as the co-chair of the Republican Israel Caucus and so much more, and it's always a delight to have him with us. Congressman, welcome back, and thank you. I know you're out in God's country. I appreciate you taking a few months to talk with us.
Frank, it's always good to chat with you and your listeners.
Thank you. Congressman, one of the things that is kind of now in sharp relief in the aftermath, particularly of the attack in Orlando, is the distinct problem that we don't seem to really understand what we're up against. And this was evidenced in the redacted transcript of the shooter's calls in 9/11. I'm interested in your thoughts on that, and if you might tell us a little bit about the effort of your Democratic colleagues to sort of divert attention further onto gun control, and what you think of that idea.
They had this sit-in, and they were trying to bring back the days of civil rights protests in the 60s, and yet their objective was to take away civil rights, to impose restrictions on our Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms in a way that is against civil rights. And they are shifting attention, if they can get away with it, away from terrorism and the influence of ISIS on homegrown terrorists like Omar Mateen in Orlando, and they're trying to put it on gun control. You know, even if their solutions had been enforced, that would not have stopped Mateen. So it's ironic that they really don't even have solutions. The ones they proposed wouldn't have made a difference.
When you hear the administration talking terrorism, if you will, or violent extremism, as they call it, having nothing to do with Sharia, with the jihad that it impels, or with Islam more broadly, it does seem as though that's blinding us to certain realities. And we were talking earlier in the program with Dr. Zudi Jasser, who testified before Senator Ted Cruz earlier this week. And he really made the point that not only is this precluding us from being able to prevent violence by understanding what's coming and nipping it in the bud, but it also is really undermining people like himself, reform-minded Muslims, that we seem to be doing the bidding of, the Muslim Brotherhood and its ilk. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, Frank, the president refuses to even mention the phrase Islamist terrorism or jihadism, for that matter. And he just doesn't get it. If he refuses to even acknowledge the source of these inspired attacks, ISIS and other related inspired attacks, then we can't really deal with the problem. You know, it starts with having our eyes wide open as to where the problem comes from. It's kind of like his inability to have a foreign policy strategy. He's just letting Syria and Iraq deteriorate. It happened in Libya also under Hillary Clinton. They just let conditions deteriorate. At this point, he's waiting and hoping he can wash his hands of it and let the next president deal with it. But when we precipitously withdrew from Iraq without any status of forces agreement, no U.S. presence, they turned to Iran. Things deteriorate between the Sunnis and Shiites, or in Syria when he withdrew from the red line that he had given to Bashar Assad without any consequences. Things just deteriorate, and we're at the point where ISIS. Yeah, predictably so. So ISIS now has huge territory. They call it a caliphate, and they're finding disturbed people, aimless people, disgruntled people like Omar Mateen in Orlando to do these horrific attacks in Europe and here in the U.S. And that's going to continue. The president, and we required him to come out with a policy on Syria. He still doesn't even have that. His one proposal was to, let's do a new authorization of the use of military force. And by the way, make it very restrictive and shackle the next president. But we're not going to shackle the next president. We're not going to take his advice.
Thanks, but no thanks, so, as they say. Yeah. You know, I'm sure that the administration or its apologists would claim, well, this, you know, we're rolling up the Islamic State. They have less territory today than they used to. But that doesn't take into account that they've opened up new franchises in places like Libya, for example, and elsewhere in sub-Saharan Africa. Hey, speaking of the broader problem, Congressman Doug Lamborn, I wanted to ask you about the relationship of the United States government under President Obama to the Palestinians, including among them, I'm sorry to say, it seems Hamas, the very much terrorist franchise there, associated, by the way, with the Muslim Brotherhood, of course. And more broadly, sir, what do you make of the U.S. policy towards Israel?
You know, I'm working with others in Congress to call attention to the fact that we are giving hundreds of millions of dollars to the Palestinians through the UNRWA program overseen by the United Nations to
this is the welfare relief agency, right?
Yeah. That's what it stands for. And yet this group through the UN is giving money to Palestinian groups and organizations that are inspiring hatred. They're inciting hatred and terrorism through the textbooks that they put out and other public acts that they make, payments that they give to the families of terrorists who murder innocents in Israel. And yet we're funding that with very few conditions, fewer, if any, conditions. That's the kind of short-sightedness that our administration is doing that does not create peace in the Middle East and actually is making things worse.
Congressman, let me turn finally to something near and dear to your heart, I know. The president seems determined to get all of those in Guantanamo Bay out. Some he's just evidently going to turn loose on foreign countries and therefore probably in short order foreign battlefields. Some I think he still intends to bring to the United States, even though that's not permissible under existing law. One of the places where they might be put is Supermax, not too far from you. What is your view of whether the president can do this under the law and whether Congress will take further steps to ensure that he doesn't?
Congress will do everything, and I will do everything we can to prevent him from doing that. However, he has acted above the law on other occasions. Like with DACA, he said 20 times, I don't have the right to give immigrants who are here illegally citizenship or to not deport them, and yet he turns around and does exactly that. So with Guantanamo Bay, Frank, we here in Colorado are very disturbed about the fact that they might be brought to our soil and put in our communities here in Colorado. But whether it's in Colorado or anywhere that they would come, there's so many problems. There are security problems. There are radicalization of others problems when you put them in a civilian system. There are constitutional problems. They would be able to demand certain kinds of habeas corpus rights, or if they go to trial, the release and the open hearing of a lot of sensitive intelligence sources and methods that would be detrimental, would be devastating to our intelligence gathering in that part of the world. There'd be so many things wrong with bringing them to our soil. And it's all based on the foolish campaign promise he made to close down Guantanamo. He's broken all kinds of other promises. Why can't he break this one? And he says, yeah, what? He says that this incites the radicals to come against the West. No, they came against the West in 9/11 before even heard of Guantanamo Bay.
Congressman Doug Lambourne, we have to let it go at that for the moment. I appreciate very much your time, the great work you do on behalf of the people of the 5th District of Colorado and all of us, for that matter, on the House Armed Services Committee and elsewhere. Keep it up. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon, sir. Next up, we'll be talking with Nina Shea of the Hudson Institute on genocide against Christians and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. in an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about civilization jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization. The Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hello, I'm Ace Lyons. As a retired 4-star admiral who served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, is a special privilege for me to talk to you about an important new book just released by the Center for Security Policy, China Prepares for Conflict, and Why We Must Do the Same. The book explains that while the Obama administration has dithered over the deterioration of the Middle East and ignored Asia, China has been moving to challenge and displace the dominant role the United States has played in this region and the world since the end of World War II. I am one of 9 co-authors of this important book. The others are former Senator Jim Talent, Gordon Chang, Peter Navarro, Kevin Freeman, Bill Gertz, Frank Gaffney, Fred Flights, and Dean Chang. I explained in my chapter how China's efforts over the last 20 years to seize control of almost the entire South China Sea is an indication of new assertiveness to advance its regional dominance at the expense of the United States. I take issue with President Obama's benign neglect of the threat from China and how Beijing is building islands in the South China Sea that it plans to turn into stationary aircraft carriers to threaten freedom of navigation in this region. Like the other authors of this book, I believe the next president must act immediately to restore American leadership and its military power, both of which have been seriously undermined by the disastrous policies of President Obama. We urgently need to modernize and increase the size of our land, naval, and air forces to stand up to China and other adversaries worldwide. We also need to recognize and counter the growing cyber and intelligence threats from China. The bottom line is that our nation needs to act now. I strongly commend this important book, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. You can read it for free as an ebook on the Center's website, securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back and joined by one of the women I admire most in America at the moment. She is Nina Shea, a person of great courage and vision who has been fighting on behalf of international human rights as a lawyer, as a leader of various organizations, notably at Freedom House and now at the Hudson Institute, specializing in religious liberty, and is also a commissioner for many years on the International Religious Freedom Commission of the United States. Nina has been contributing mightily in various ways, notably through her writings at places like National Review and First Things, and also in her many books, including most recently Persecuted, The Global Assault on Christians. Nina Shea, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you.
Great to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
As I say, I don't think anybody really has been monitoring and raising the alarm and trying to do something about what has now been recognized in its fashion by the government as genocide against Christians in notably Iraq and Syria. And give us a sense, if you would, Nina, maybe at the 30,000-foot level of what is happening to the Christian communities in those nations and beyond.
Well, they are being eradicated through Islamic extremist violence. You know, the most recent event, of course, has been ISIS attacks that started 2 years ago, or 3 years ago in Syria, and then went on to Iraq, and has just really eliminated virtually an entire Christian community from Iraq proper. They're all now huddled in camps in Kurdistan, in Iraqi Kurdistan. It's too dangerous for these Iraqi Christians to even live in other parts of the country where ISIS is not. ISIS, of course, is in Mosul and Nineveh, where they used to live. But they were all had been pushed to Nineveh over the preceding decade because of extremist violence from Islamic State of Iraq, or before that, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So it's been one series of, you know, terrorist attacks after another, blowing up churches, assassinating religious leaders, taking Christians hostage really by the thousands. And that's been a quiet development. It happens family by family, and the Muslim terrorists take them and demand ransom, and sometimes they release them once they get the ransom, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they kill them anyhow. Sometimes they kill the loved one who brings the ransom. Sometimes they take the priest or bishop who tries to ransom these Christians captive and demands more money.
Right. And so other cases, they're enslaving the women, turning them into sex slaves.
They're enslaving the women. There's just, you know, and there's a myth
one horror after another.
That Christians are not subject to enslavement and rape because they're people of the book. And that's a pet theory, actually, Frank, of the State Department right now and the UN. The UN has just come out with the Commission on Inquiry in Syria has just come out with a report on the Yazidis saying that this is genocide. They say the Christians, while they're not treated well, are treated with respect like people of the book and given a jizya option, which is false. It's a false narrative. It does not happen.
Jizya, meaning basically that if you submit, you will be allowed to survive, if not on a very exalted level. Certainly, you were third, fourth, fifth class citizens. Nina Shea, the question, I guess, is that a function, both certainly at the United Nations and probably in our own State Department, of the preeminent role being played these days by this so-called Organization of Islamic Cooperation and their efforts to sort of promote Islamic supremacism?
Well, I think that there has been a tremendous influence by that organization. This is a 56-member state member organization with the goal of eliminating Israel and promoting Islam. That's their stated goal, is to promote Islam. And they brought the blasphemy campaign to the UN, and every year has tried to get passed a resolution universalizing Islamic blasphemy code.
Right, criminalizing speech. Also refugees. I mean, a disproportionate number, as you know, of Muslims as well. And let me just ask you, because you've been talking mostly about Syria here, but drill down on Iraq, if you would, as well, Nina Shea. You had a piece recently at National Review Online that was very important about what's happened at the hands of the government of Iraq, no less, to many of the people who found themselves in harm's way there.
Yes, Fallujah was taken back from ISIS last Sunday. It was the general there, the Iraqi general, announced it was fully liberated last Sunday. You know, a couple days ago. And the 85 civilian refugees that came out of there found that they had nothing. They were met with nothing. They had, the government had four camps when they needed 20. I mean, it was a sandstorm. It was 117 degrees. It's desert-like terrain. And they had, 1,800 women sharing one latrine in one of the camps. There was sacks of flour dropped off, but no stoves or fuel to cook it with, so it was just flour. They had less than a third of the water rations that they normally give. So it was no medicine. That was all unfolding last week, and the aid agencies started sounding the alarm. You know, the Red Cross and so forth started saying, this is, you know, apocalyptic. You have to get, you know, the U.S. has to put in more money, which we then did. Now we're going to go on to Mosul. This is the last redoubt of ISIS in Iraq. It's in Mosul. And the U.S. has been making statements to some extent about that, that we're going to do it now. And certainly Iraq has been, the Iraqi military and government has saying now it's Mosul. And while Mosul does need to be liberated, they have to think through this plan, because there are up to 2 million people in Mosul, not 85,000, but 2 million. And they will flood out. And the danger, Frank, is that they will also flood out because there won't be anything set up for them, like in Fallujah this week. They will flood out into the abandoned and defenseless Christian towns and villages in the Nineveh Plain, and they will lodge themselves there, and no one will ever adjudicate that land. And they will, the Christians who are now refugees in tents and shipping containers up in Kurdistan, will be forever dispossessed.
Yeah. And Nineshay, one of the things, even let us just say a word of thanks to the Kurds for providing that safe haven. But this is a very untenable situation for both the Kurds and I know for the refugees, the Christian refugees. Speaking of the Christian refugees, you know, Nina, one of the things that I'm just struck by, and I know you've been working very hard on at the Hudson Institute's Center for Religious Freedom, is the seeming almost wholesale absence of the Christian church around the world, including here in the United States, in terms of responding to the plight of their co-religionists, let alone helping something be done to alleviate it. Well, what's up with that?
Yes, I've written about this, and I'm very perplexed about it. It's baffling, Frank, that here are these people who are sacrificing everything, the ultimate sacrifice for their faith, who are great examples of faithfulness and love and peace. There are two Jesuits priests who were men of peace. That's what they did, was dialogue and try to, you know, show love by taking up, creating houses for disabled children of all faiths. And they were assassinated by ISIS or other Islamic extremists.
This was in Iraq and Syria. Mm-hmm.
In Syria, and they were two Jesuits. I went to the Jesuit headquarters in Rome and into their church. You know, you hear, pray for the refugees or pray for peace or pray for the Middle East, but you never hear of a single name of a Christian, except those from the first century, of course. But you never hear of a martyr.
Contemporary martyrs. Yeah, Nina Shea, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. We've got so much more to talk with you about, and I hope you'll indulge us by coming back soon. And in the meantime, safe travels and Godspeed in your important work at the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom. Keep it up. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will come back again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.